Good evening, everybody. I'd like to welcome everybody to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is David. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank everybody for coming out tonight, everybody, all the home group members and people who just volunteered to come and set up the room. It takes a lot of people doing a little bit to make something like this happen, and there's something special that I think happens when we all come together and break bread and chat, and it's just beautiful. For those who care to join, let's have a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. I need to remember to do this. Everybody silence your cell phones. And feel free not to look at them during the meeting either. Just, you know, for me. Yeah. No, I'll do that. I'll say silence your cell phones, and then I'll remember to turn mine off later, and then mine will be the one that goes off. Also, we respectfully ask those present to please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. These actions are contained in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. The AA preamble says, Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We're self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open Big Book step study. Normally what happens, if you come back next week, we'll be doing step one out of the Big Book. We usually have a home group member chairs the meeting, and we have two speakers share their experience, strength, and hope on step one. And the next week will be, oddly enough, step one again. And then the week after that will be step two, etc. It takes us 13 weeks to go through all 12 steps, and then we have an event like this. So you're here on an event like this night. So tonight, that's what we're doing. We're going to have a speaker. We have Phyllis from Gloucester. I am really excited to bring her here. I just love this woman. I have a lot of respect for her program, her message, and I won't take up any more of her time. Phyllis.
I'm an alcoholic.
Yes.
And the home group where I got sober copied this thing from Toastmasters, where up on this thing here, they have this little thing with lights on it. And it's a green light when you have so much time, and a yellow light, and then you get like a stop, like stop. So you don't have that here, but I'll try to watch so that you're not tapping your watches. so the what has become customary to do a series of remarks about identifying. My sobriety date is April 15th, 1982, And my home group is called Fellowship of the Spirit. We meet in Gloucester County at Abingdon Episcopal Church two nights a week. On Wednesday night, we have a beginner meeting at 7, and at 8 o'clock on Saturday nights, we have a speaker meeting, and I'm recruiting a little bit tonight here, so it's going to happen. I'm the June person. And I am sponsored. I've been in touch with my sponsor today. And I sponsor other women, and what am I leaving out, people that do this? I think that's it. Try to work the steps and do service, which we will talk about some more. So, I don't speak a lot. I know sometimes you have speakers here that, you know, get asked to speak in places where they send them a ticket and they fly to Iceland or Ireland or France, you know, go on cruises, things like that. I don't think that's ever going to be my my thing, but I enjoy the folks that are very sincere, entertaining, and funny. I don't know where I'll be on that spectrum, but the whole point here is to, as we say, talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and to talk in some ways about how we've developed a relationship with a higher power. And I'm going to just do it right up front. Chris R., who was here, when was it? Not long ago. I don't know if he said it when he was here, but I've listened to him, and I've heard him speak in person once, listened to him on recording quite a bit. He talks about how we have one thing to offer here. We're like a shoe store with one pair of shoes. It's called spiritual awakening. I love that remark. So how do we do that? What do we have to do that? Well, anyway, so part of it is sharing your experience, strength, and hope. So let's see. I'm going to try not to talk too much about drinking and history and all that. I'm actually sober about 3 times longer than I drink. So it's an experience in sobriety. It's kind of like how you rank things. You know, some of my experience is not so great, some of it's medium, and some of it's pretty awesome. So anyway, I was born in Nebraska, and the town was a lot like TV towns of small town America. So it had its pluses. There's a very big community spirit, and you needed to kind of conform, so there was that. But I was there until about 8th grade. So we had a very sincere, rooted in the community type of family. There were several churches in town. Everyone kind of chose their church, and you did your thing. And so in our church, we had members going back, you know, several generations of that church. My ancestors came from Switzerland in the 1860s and settled on the land there. And so did a lot of other people. So it turns out that I'm like 3rd and 4th and 5th cousins with a lot of the kids I went to school with. My sister's doing genealogy now, so we got all that going on. And with Facebook, now I've reconnected with some of the people that I left that town when I was in 8th grade, but I'm connected on Facebook. It's kind of fun. Anyway, so growing up, I had a grandmother that was in the Women's Christian Temperance Union, you know, the non-drinking thing. The church we went to was a non-drinking church, things like that. So what was my experience with alcohol then? My dad, I found this in my diary when I was a sophomore in high school. Actually, I wrote it in my diary when I was a sophomore in high school. And I found my diary a few years back. You know how when you move, boxes kind of get stored somewhere, and then they sort of reappear, and you unearth things that maybe you hadn't seen for a while? I hadn't seen that diary in decades, and it turned up in the year 2000 when we moved into the house we're in now. And I opened it up, and somewhere in my sophomore year of high school, I wrote one line in my diary: Dad went to AA. So Dad needed to go to AA. Dad was kind of like the, how would you say, here you have the family, you know, everybody doing the things and all that. And when you're in a farming community, and these are a lot of people, like cousins moved over here from Switzerland, so everybody was kind of helping each other and cooperating, and there was kind of a code of conduct. And then there was Dad, you know, so we had this family, very, you know, hopefully well-respected, but we became, you know, we had things going on. So he left and we moved to town, and things were fine for a while. My mother was one of those people who just kept on going. You know, she's one of these cheerful people who doesn't even need a program to be spiritually in tune. She's been spiritually in tune forever. So she kept the house running. She went back to college, she met someone, and we moved from this small town in Nebraska to an even smaller town in Kansas. A little bit culturally different, this little town, and so it kind of started me on my pathway of experiencing being around people who were drinking while they were drinking, because they always sent me to my grandparents and my sister when the drinking was happening around the house, which is probably a good idea. I came home one time and there was this hole about this big around in the ceiling in our one of our screened-in porches, and oh, what's that? And here's the fun contrast. My mother was valedictorian of her class. She played the piano very beautifully. She could play Rhapsody of Blues. She played Rachmaninoff's Concerto in C sharp minor at her eighth grade graduation. The kind of person my mom is. Anyway, so in the ceiling above the baby grand piano is this hole. Well, what's that? Oh, Dad shot a hole in the ceiling with a .30-06 rifle. I see. He was a rifle champion, but, you know, a few drinks and... so, but he had left. So she was in the clubs, you know, all the ladies' clubs and all that. But she went back to college and met this gentleman. We moved to Kansas when they got married. They had three kids. We had three kids. So it was like eight people in a house with one bathroom. That was awesome. But in this little town, my step-siblings were pretty lively folks, and they towed the line in a lot of ways, but they really liked to sneak out of the house at night and do all this cool stuff. And so we had these neighbor guys. We had my sister and I were boyfriend and girlfriend with these two brothers next door, so we would do all these, you know, adventures late at night and all that. And I just thought, you know, I was kind of a nerd when I was growing up. And this to me was just like, you know, I had arrived, and I began to arrive being around people who drink, because this was a largely German Catholic town, and so that's kind of the European model of just everybody drinks. And when you have a sheriff that comes around town about once a night, so you have the big downtown auditorium, and there's a wedding dance, and so everybody's drinking, you know. So I would be a designated driver because we had a very strict household where the rules were, if you don't like them, you don't have to be here. Okay. So I kind of followed that, but I really enjoyed, I just loved being around the drinkers and doing all the drinky stuff. You know, I love going to dances, I love going to parties. There was a bar that was owned by my best friend's uncle. We went to the bar all the time and danced and hung out. So that swinging lifestyle just seemed like a nice thing, a fun thing. But of course I wasn't gonna drink. So I went to college and I wasn't gonna drink. And so one of the things that we learn here, I know there's some people here that are relatively new. So one thing that has come to me more and more over time in sobriety is the very, very specific and clear definition of what is an alcoholic. An alcoholic is set apart, as it talks about in the big book, as being different from other kinds of drinkers. We have these things that happen to us that do not happen to other people. So if they happen for us, this is kind of like the uh-oh. If these things happen for you, you're probably an alcoholic. So, for example, you think about drinking a lot, and you plan on drinking, and you're obsessed in some ways with drinking. When you're not drinking, you're thinking about drinking. Well, my very first thing that happened to me was I made a decision. Oh, and the other thing was I didn't want to be like my dad. Anybody identify with that? You had an alcoholic parent. You were not going to be like them. Absolutely not. No way, no how, you weren't going to be like them. So I wasn't. But somewhere along the spring of my freshman year, it looked to me like my friends were having a lot of fun going down to the bars and drinking beer and all that. So I thought, next time I get invited, I planned this like months in advance. This is like towards the end of the semester. In the fall, when they invite me, I'm going to go, and I am going to drink. So it was like this graduation party, you know, like I'm going to graduate into drinking. And I don't know that normal people think about, you know, how we're going to do this now, you know. And the other thing was that how I thought about drinking was never like my sister thinks about drinking. Oh, we'll just say my sister as a great example. And I didn't know exactly how she drank for sure, because most of the time when I was with her, if there was drinking going on, I was probably pretty drunk, so I couldn't tell who was drunk and who wasn't. But we talked about it, and she said, well, three is my limit, you know. And the only time I've ever gone beyond three was when my sister's a professor and her husband's a professor, and they travel the world doing science things, and so they're like with the other people in Japan or Russia or wherever, and they're having a dinner. And you know, in those cultures there's a lot of drinking. So they fill your glass, and you're supposed to leave your glass half full if you don't want any more, unless you don't understand that, and then you just keep, you know, like in the Midwest we're taught to clean our plate, right? So she got drunk a few times and had hangovers, and she said, I'm never going to do that again. And I laughed so hard when she said that, because she said that's happened to me maybe twice, maybe three times, you know, right? And so then after that, she didn't. So three is her limit. And I said, well, you know, I said that too. I'm never going to do that again. Every weekend. Almost every weekend. Every Sunday morning when the horror was upon me. Anyway, so their idea of drinking is, well, we're having this event where people who are accomplishing things are meeting together for a reason perhaps related to that. Like, we're all in the same work, you know, it's the grad students who are here for a dinner, it's, you know, celebrating somebody's success, you know, and we have a little wine, you know, or a little something. And that's how that is. Now, that's normal drinking. You know, here's a little wine, a little beer, a little something. For me, remember what I heard, my friends were gonna go drinking, right? Well, here's how that went. That was pitchers of beer poured into these things. Somebody told me what they were called. They're these giant goblet things. Somebody probably knows the name of them. Anyway, giant frosted goblets of beer from pitchers, and lots of it, you know, just like slosh down that stuff. And that's drinking, you know, that's what you do. Like, drinking is the occasion, rather than the occasion has a little drinking. Drinking is the occasion. So my thinking from the first was, A, I'm planning it, and B, I'm gonna do a lot of it once I can do it, because that's what it is. Now, that pretty much meets the definition, right? The very first time I thought about drinking, I thought I did not want to limit my drinking, because I didn't know it at the time, but once I would take a drink, the drink would say, let's have some more and keep going. And that's exactly what happened. So when I was a sophomore, that's what I did. And then over about a 6 week, maybe 2 month period, it began to be more and more attractive, and I wanted to do it more and more. And so I figured out ways to do it more and more. So during college, lots of drinking, began to be some trouble, because you may not exactly be able to tell, but I'm a boomer, and I went to college in the fall of 1968, which at Kansas State University was a time when change was gonna happen, but it hadn't quite happened yet. So that year, we had rules, like my mom had at her dorm at Nebraska. You had to be in at a certain time, you had to check out, they had to know where you were going over the weekend, etc. Somehow during that year, they managed through the student council or whatever to have co-ed dorms the next year, and no limits, and you could have boys in your room, guys in your room, except I think after midnight and before noon or something like that. So we just, you know, kept them there until noon. That's how that went. Just have to stay here till noon. That's how you roll. Anyway, so that was my crowd. Yes, we were fun. So lots of, and not always happy times. I was often very afraid, often very frustrated, very frightened. What am I gonna do with my life? I don't know. This is all so hard. But in the meantime, I could drink and have fun, and that seemed good. So I did a lot of adventuring. I think someone spoke at a meeting, I love to steal lines. They said the only thing in, you know, in the book it talks about all the things we tried about our drinking, you know, drinking only beer and wine, you know, swearing off with and without a solemn oath, taking a trip, not taking a trip. And so this one speaker said, the only thing I didn't do was not taking a trip. So I identified with that. So I liked to go on the road, both hitchhiking and in Volkswagen vans, whichever was the easiest thing to do at the time, and enjoyed that kind of freewheeling lifestyle. And eventually, as I was heading towards graduating from college, I wound up getting a job that I could show my parents. You know, I kind of wanted to have a life that there was this, you know, it talks about how, in the book, it talks about how alcoholics have that two-sided thing. Like when I was in high school, the two-sided thing was I actually really, truly enjoyed the church youth group. I loved it, and I liked being involved in organizations and kind of, you know, going to these big meetings. And we went to this big meeting in Estes Park, and I thought that was awesome. And we went to a trip in Chicago. We were actually there during this trip to Chicago with the youth group during the convention when they had the big riots in Chicago where they were going, the whole world is watching. We weren't at that. We were, you know, sequestered away from it, but we were there. So I just thought that was the coolest thing. But back to the trying to have, you know, this dual life. So I went to church, but I hung out with the kids that drank. And after college, my friends, I could just, you know, I wanted to be a hippie, but I just could never completely let go. I think I always wore mascara, for example. You know, I was never that totally natural person. I mean, just little things, you know. And I couldn't steal things, and I couldn't, you know, I tried a couple of times to do some things that were sort of recommended, you know, like those steal this book stuff. Some of you are familiar with that. And you know, just completely going off of normal everything, you know, travel with the Grateful Dead, that kind of thing. Couldn't do it. So I got a real job, and I was with some people who, let's call it, were operating a business that, you know, now, let me give you a little stock tip. You want to really make some money? Invest in cannabis. Right? Well, that was true back then, too. But you didn't pay taxes on it. You know, now you'd have to have a lot of lawyers to help you with that part. But anyway, so those are my friends, right? A lot of things were free. That was cool. A lot of money you could just spend, because what else? And so one of them got in trouble, and then it was kind of a domino effect, and a bunch of them got in trouble. And think about this. This was before the, you know, what we have now, where there's like cameras watching you everywhere. My particular boyfriend just left. He just went away because he was going to be arrested if he didn't. So he went to California, and I had to decide whether I was going to move out there or keep my state job in Topeka, Kansas. I had a state job in one of those buildings where it's that half underground level. That's where my office was. And so you stood up and it was about eye level. You could see the ground outside. Those concrete block walls painted that particular shade of green. And we didn't have calculators then, so I had to hand do all these calculations I did and all this kind of thing. And so he was gone, and he kept saying, "Are you gonna come out here?" So they had this, they have a legitimate business because, you know, I think that scared us. So they had an office in Sausalito. Everybody know where Sausalito is? It's Marin County, San Francisco Bay. And they had friends that had those houseboats, you know, on the bay. And then they also had one at the bottom of Topanga Canyon in Los Angeles, if you know where that is. The beach out there, and so pretty nice both places. But you know, I had read the media. I thought I was pretty slick, you know, because I read Time Magazine and all these things. And you know, people in New York kind of thought Los Angeles was the lesser cultural area, you know, like LA is kind of tacky. So I thought LA was kind of tacky, so I didn't want to live there. But Marin County, definitely Marin County. So my problem is that by the time I had decided to quit my job and move out there, they got rid of the Marin County place, so now I'm moving to L.A. Oh, no. So there I am in L.A., and a lot of you probably remember when you could drink and you could do a lot of things like I was describing, you know, where the police aren't watching, you know, all that kind of stuff. I had my car broken into one time back in the early 70s, and this is in Manhattan, Kansas, where I was going to college, and they stole this suitcase and it had some jewelry in it, and I thought, I'm leaving a party. It's about 2 a.m. And, you know, how you can imagine how many of you would be at that time of night after a party. And I was pretty drunk. And I thought, I'm going to call the police and report this. So I went, and there was this little market open, and I put some money in the phone, and I called the police, and they came, and I bought all these mint lifesavers so that I wouldn't smell like alcohol. I sit in the police car, and I'm drawing and drawing of the thing, and they didn't do anything. They're just kind of like, they're probably just like, get out of here. But anyway, that's how that was. So I almost got a DUI in Los Angeles. So I was beginning to get, you know, they talk about how you might become a lone wolf, the remonstrances of your friends because you're doing all these things. And so the people around me were saying, I don't know, you know, you're going up to, I'm trying to think of the name of the bar, the Pioneer Bar, was that it, up in Topanga Canyon? Anyway, there was a bar up there, and then there was the Crazy Horse in Malibu and some Irish place down in Venice. And anyway, they kept saying, well, especially if you're driving up to Topanga Canyon, if you've ever been to the mountains, whoa, maybe I should, I'll just do it like Oprah. We'll just, I can call you tonight. What's your experience? No. Anyway, sorry. So where was I? Somewhere in Topanga. Oh yes, driving in the mountain. So there was this heir of one of the corporation's fortunes or something, and LA and California in general are where if you're kind of an exotic heir of a wealthy family, that's a great place to go because you can buy like 15 acres on top of a mountain and build your moon house and your, you know, all that. So there was someone that had one of those things. We drove up there one time. It was on the, you had to drive down this ridge. It was like two, you know, those dirt tracks. We're in Virginia. We still have those dirt lanes, you know, where it's like there's grass in the middle and then two dirt tracks. And this is like, the mountain is literally here and the dirt track is there. And you can't see the road from the side of the van that you're looking down from. So we go out there. But anyway, they had all these animals, like camels and stuff. And they were telling me, you know, they fall off the mountain and they die because it's so steep. It's been tragic. And so they're saying, you know, you could be driving on one of those roads drunk and just drive off the road. And it's not like driving in the ditch. You know, you're going to go down 1,000 feet. Of course, I, you know, scoffed at that. But anyway, we don't like people telling us about our drinking. But I began to be more isolated. So I broke up with a guy, several iterations of guys. That was my whole thing, iterations of guys. Iterations of places to live, moving around. But I thought, you know, okay, this is it. I'm getting my late 20s, I gotta get it together. So I worked on that and I got a career and that was hard. Very hard, but I could drink on the weekends, so that was my thing. I decided I was going to drink on weekends only. And of course, I had to get a new set of friends and contacts and everything. So I had my office in a kind of a nice neighborhood, and I began to get some clients equivalent to that neighborhood. And so they would invite me to events, and I remember going to one in particular, and there were people there that you probably shouldn't be drunk in front of, you know, like bank presidents and stuff. And so the next day I get this call from my client. I'm sure that this was something that rarely happens, but I think you were a little overserved at the party. And indeed, there was a woman there with one of those pink ultra suede outfits that were popular back then. And I hate those little champagne glasses that are plastic. Yeah. Aren't they so awkward? I mean, they're just gonna tip out of your hand every time, aren't they? You know? And so that's what happened. It was spilled on her pink ultra suede outfit. Anyway, but that began for me because I was so driven in the business thing. I began to see, now this is going to not be so workable. So then I just won't hang out with those people at all because I can't hang out with them if I'm not drinking, and I can't hang out with them if I am drinking. And so then my world got smaller and smaller and smaller. And I began to concentrate even more on a comorbid eating disorder that I had. And eventually, I called Overeaters Anonymous. I'll just mention that briefly because I was struggling with that. And I go to one of these meetings and I'm introduced out of the 12 steps. And I look about like I look now, because that was bulimia. And I'm in the meeting, and this is my first experience of people just saying things, you know, that we do in the program. Well, so you're not bulimic by any chance, are you? Now, if any of you know about bulimia, you don't tell people about that. Anyone ever. I mean, no, they don't. You don't tell. So I thought, my gosh, I'm exposed. What am I going to do now? I said, well, yes. How did you know? He said, well, you don't look like you have any weight to lose. Okay, I guess. Well, so then I didn't drink for 60 days because that was what you did back then. You had this like food plan. And then after 60 days, you could drink. Now, here's how my mind works. Okay, now I can drink, but I'm following a plan with calories in it, right? So let's think about this. On Saturday, let's see, 1,200 calories. Okay, so you can have breakfast, you can have lunch, maybe about 600 calories for dinner. So just don't eat dinner, just drink. So I tried that. Boy, that didn't work very well at all. So that began, that was in 1978, that began a few years of just, you know, kind of spiraling down mentally and emotionally. And I think, when was it I showed up on the steps of AA? January of 79. And I actually quit drinking then and called myself an alcoholic, but I didn't think you guys were, I don't know, on the same track that I was on, kind of, you know. Everybody was just so kind of like different places. Like, I remember hearing a woman say that she had quit her job because it was too stressful, and I thought, well, I can't possibly associate with people who just can't handle it in business. You know, like, no. I mean, we didn't have Tony Robbins back then, but we had this thing called EST, and there was just a lot of people that really wanted to really make it in life, and there were good moral and good emotional things there. One problem for me, lack of power was my dilemma. You know, I noticed that I wasn't changing, and I was unchanging to the point where I was getting suicidal. And I had kind of started to go back to meetings after the last guy iteration had enough. And so I'm going to meetings, and people from Pacific Group, it turns out, are kind of finding me and being friendly, because that's what they do. And I went to one of their meetings accidentally, mind you, because this is the kind of group where you're warned by other people, don't go there. They're going to try to control you. They're going to give you structure. And they're going to ask you to do things. You know, you're going to have commitments, and you're going to have to, you know, do all this rigorous stuff. And, you know, we want to live free. And so I thought, ooh, okay. So I thought they were kind of creepy, these, you know, enthusiasts. But by the time I was starting to get suicidal, I actually accidentally one night went to one of those meetings. And now, having been in the success group, I'm thinking, okay, what do they say in the success group? You got to commit to things, be responsible, do what you said you would do when you said you would do it, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so, oh, that's what they're saying from up here. They're talking about that. And they're not wandering around in the parking lot and talking and getting up and down during the meeting and getting coffee and making noise and distractions so you can't even hear the things being read. So I'm thinking, cognitive dissonance, you know, because they seem okay. So then I went to a meeting and I heard Clancy speak. And he is someone that I think, having spent 10 years in Pacific Group, I can tell you that there's a lot of dedication there and a lot of just selflessness and a very unique sense of humor and personality. And for example, I remember the night that I became GSR, I joined Pacific Group, because the suicide thing was kind of getting to me a little bit. You know, I heard him talk around that time, and I prayed. I actually prayed, and the voice came in my head, go talk to Clancy. Well, I thought, well, let me just go to the group. So I went to this place called Serenity Manor, and I'd been going to some meetings there, and this newcomer was there. And I thought, well, let me just bring a newcomer. You know, I haven't had a drink for 2 years, and here I am with a newcomer to join your group, you know? Like, so I'm all right. I really am. Suicidal. So I had called suicide prevention, by the way, the hotline, and I was like to say, hold please. So then they come on the line and you tell them your story. Well, you know, I owe money to my partner that I did this little business thing with, and he doesn't know it, and you know, I'm really feeling bad. And well, what you need to do is just sit down with him and work it out. And I thought, I don't need you to tell me that. So after a while in Pacific Group, after a month or so, you know, they're getting tired of me dodging the sponsor question. Do you have a sponsor yet? You know, what are you doing? What are your commitments? You know, all that stuff. Are you in the steps yet? They took me to a restaurant and just assigned me a sponsor. And so we got going in that stuff. And she was one of these people that was very kind of no nonsense. It was really pretty good because when she said stuff, I don't know why, but when she said things, I just did it. You know, I just took it. So she said, you go talk to that guy. Same thing the people at Suicide Place said, you know, but I don't know what it was. It was just the way that AA is, you know. So I waited a couple of weeks, of course, and then I called his partner and talked to him. And he said, well, you know what? I've got some money right now that I don't really need. I'll loan it to you, and when you sell your project, you can pay me back. Now, I'm sure glad I didn't kill myself, you know, over something that, you know, like suicide prevention. I mean, they know what they're talking about. I needed to work it out. But again, I didn't have the power. So that was a pretty incredible thing. And I can mark my sobriety with the awfulness and the surrender, and the awfulness and the surrender, and the awfulness and the surrender. And there's a place in the 12 and 12 where it talks about how it'd be great if we just wanted humility just because, and we wanted, you know, to be spiritual just because. But that's not usually my experience. My experience is I've tried every self-willed thing I can possibly do, and then I'm suffering pretty badly, and okay, I guess I'll do it. So I wish I could report that that changes completely when you're 36 years sober, but you know what, it doesn't. But what doesn't change also is all of the things that we get to do. And the fact that if we're here and if we're committed and if we're involved with people, that we'll find someone to help and we'll find some, you know, answers. For me, working the steps again, etc. But I'm going to talk a little bit more about the earlier sobriety. So let's see. So we got the four-step done. They didn't quite do it the way a lot of you are familiar with now. There was kind of a particular thing. I won't really go into great detail, but there seemed like there was some time and some places in sobriety where, you know, people didn't just go to the big book and work the steps like they're written out right in there. Kind of, you know, like a kind of like a history thing that you gave. But that was okay. It was, you know, things helped. So then I got busy, and I was a GSR for several years. And I became a DCM, which out there is a little bit different than here. Some of you may be from larger areas where they combine districts together, and then they have a chairperson of, I think, Diana, having been in San Francisco, they have what they call a chairman of the, like a DCMC, they call it. So I was never like that person chairing that whole meeting. So my job, a lot of what I remember from it was going to other meetings to see if they wanted GSRs. I don't know that anybody in any of those meetings ever really just jumped up and said, glad you came, we just want a GSR so bad. Let us do that now. You know, that didn't really seem to happen. But I can tell you that LA has thousands of meetings. And I don't remember, after being a DCM and in general service for a while, going to any meeting anywhere in that area and not having somebody go, hey, how are you doing? You know, just from being out there and doing this stuff. It was really great. So we also took meetings into facilities, and my first 45-minute talk was in a facility where people were heavily medicated, and that was nice, actually. That worked out. I kind of work on, so many minutes of this, so many minutes of this, so many minutes of this, and they're kind of, you know. I didn't take that personally at that point. I figured there was a reason for it. But you got a lot of practice too by taking meetings into facilities and doing the 10-minute or the panel or the whatever. And so I wanted to be with the cool kids. The cool kids had commitments, and that was just the way it was. And so for me, living life on a spiritual basis, die an alcoholic death, which for some of us could be suicide, right? So I have evidence that untreated, my mind will go to suicide. So, or we can do the stuff that we do in the program, which a lot of it is action. And so I wanted to be one of the cool kids doing the action. And it was a lot of fun, and is a lot of fun. So I got to be the co-chair of what they call the GSO picnic in LA. 1,000 people attend this thing. I was, I don't know if you can imagine which person I was on the team. There was a nice guy who smiled a lot, and everyone hugged him and loved him and all that stuff. And if you recall, I kind of fancied myself as quite the stern business person. So I was sort of the bad cop, which I learned is not, you know, a way to be, because I felt so lonely after those meetings, you know, having said, we are not going to go over the budget here, we're going to, you know, that kind of stuff. So a lot of people that know me now are like, really? You were mean like that? Yeah, I was. About 4 years of sobriety, I thought I knew everything. I became marriage material eventually. that took a while. That was another one of those milestones, you know, like, okay, let's see if we can describe this quickly. You see the person across the room, you decide that's the one. Now, being in sales, as I pretty much have been my whole career, I am trained to remove the objections to the sale, right? So you're gonna figure out, what are the problems here? What's the barrier to this working out, right? Oh, you're still married? Well, good, you work on that divorce, you know? Come on. You're not that interested in me? Well, why not, you know? We'll figure this out. I had mistaken God's will for mine. Anyway, so what I discovered was a rather adult idea, which is that you might be super attracted to someone, but that may not be the person that you need to hook up with for the rest of your life. That may not be that person. So whatever your brain is telling you on that side of the brain that's going, woo, you know, the other side might be going, and I did this, literally. I went to Pacific Group Wednesday night meeting, Saltaire and Sunset Boulevard, you can still go there. I remember standing at the corner, waiting for the light to change, to walk across the street and thinking, oh, now this is yet another one. This is probably about the last one. I'm thinking, gosh, I really like him. He hasn't gotten a divorce yet. He's one of the ones I had the lunch with about the divorce. He's living with his girlfriend. And she works for him in his office. Wow. So, and then on the other side, I'm thinking, but he's so cute. Then I thought, okay, it's beginning to dawn on me that just the emotional, whatever that thing is not it, you know? Like, once we're a little more spiritually fit, we can begin to behave a little more like a mature adult. You know, like, this is not good. You know, how can you possibly, with any common sense whatsoever, be thinking this is a remote possibility? So I remember thinking, you know, I got the T-square there. You learn this in business, right? You know, and it's really adding up on the not side. And I thought, all right, you know. But the one before that, and kind of a little bit after that too, I think. I'm kind of getting my train of thought here. But when we broke up, we had to be declared to undo. We had this guy in our program who, his wife was in Al-Anon, and she was a psychologist, and we went to her. Together, we went to her, and she said, last rites, you're done, this is it, don't call each other. And we had to make a pact that we wouldn't. I don't know, has anybody here ever had one of those relationships where you can't stop calling the other person, each other, reconvening it? And it was really horrible. And so I'm like, whatever you would call it, getting over the pain or having the pain or whatever. And I had this, like, I'm like, oh, I'm in so much pain, God, why? Little voice came in my head, if you can get through this sober, you can help other people get through this sober. It put a meaning and a purpose around the suffering. And after that, I felt so free and so just like, and this is the essence of the spiritual awakening that we're talking about here. Like, what's the difference between I have to have this thing, I have to have it, and, well, maybe if I don't get it, I'll be all right. Because where, you know, in the ABCs, my sponsor used to say to me, I got a different sponsor that tried to convert people that were not into her particular gender into, you know, her thing was, oh, he's gay, oh, I'll convert him. That was her thing. One of them. And then she dated a guy that was foreclosing on her house. And anyway, I thought, that's the sponsor for me. She got over it. But she would say, remember, no human power. And so, to me, what's on the other side of the pain is the surrender and the peace. And I felt like if I never, ever have a relationship, it's okay. Except for that one little page in the 12 and 12 where it says some people never find someone. And I'm thinking, can I really be willing to have that? But okay. But what I realized was I'll be, as long as I am single, I'm going to be at peace as a single person and happy as a single person. And I was. I felt so good. And so what is it that we're doing here? We're working on a way so that our selfish needs and desires are let go through the power that we bring in by taking the actions that allow that power to come in and help us do those things. And that's what the steps are. And as Chris Raymer said, you know, spiritual awakening, this is the pair we've got. How do you like it? So it does work. Anyway, so I get married, and I realized I had probably idealized it like I had idealized a lot of other things. I remember thinking white picket fence, you know, you're getting all the stuff, but you're still that same person that needs to go to the program, that needs to work the steps, that needs to do all of these things. Whether you have what you thought you always wanted or not, you're still going to have days of despair. You're still going to, you know, like there's nothing material that's going to change that. And there's always going to be losses. I mean, we're all going to get older. We're all going to deal with illness, aging, and death, as they say in Buddhism. So how do we do that? We do that with a relationship with a higher power. So anyway, the final phase here is, so we get married and have a child, and at about 10 years sober, my husband got a job in Cleveland. He had worked for an aerospace company in Los Angeles, and he applied for a job at the NASA Center in Cleveland, and there's also a NASA Center, as many of you know, here. That's how we wound up here in this area, because he was at Langley for a while. And so my sponsor says, well, you know, there's this thing that I've done. Someone called Clint H. went to a conference in, I believe it was Kentucky or Tennessee. Joe H. was there. Don P. was there. Some of you know who I'm talking about. A few other people. I'm not thinking of the names, but anyway. Clint was introduced to working the steps, as many of you here do, starting on the title page and going through the book all the way through page by page, which I had heard about a couple of years before. A guy, Rob Kay, was sponsored by Clint, and this would have been, let's see, I left in 92, it would have been about 1990. Rob was talking about going through the book, and I thought, kind of the way that, you know, some of you here tonight were talking about how your doctor said you got to not have this and not have that. You know, it's like you hear these people that are having a raw diet and going to run a triathlon, and you think, that's really nice for you. A little extreme, though, don't you think? You know, that's how I thought about the big book then. And so 2 years later, though, my sponsor, I'm getting ready to leave town. I don't know what it's going to be like in Ohio. I don't know what the AA is going to be like. We had 1,200 people in our home group. I don't know if any of you have ever been there. But so she said, well, you know, I just went through the book with my best friend, Cindy, and I think you might like that. And somehow, somebody was at our table tonight saying, there was kind of about 10 years sober, I just kind of felt like, is this all there is in the program? You know, is this about how the level is going to be and it's just going to stay like this? You know, okay. But when we did the steps, some very transformational things happened for me. For example, on working the four-column inventory, as we call it. Some people don't call it that, but the fourth column is the thing on the next page where it talks about referring to our list again on page 67. We call it the fourth column, or not, but it's when we turn it around, we figure out what all these terrible people did, and then we look at, you know, okay, well, what was I doing? We set aside what they did, we look at what we were doing. What was I thinking? What was I, you know, what were my actions? What was my thinking? Where was I dishonest? All that stuff. And my number one resentment on my list, not necessarily number one lifetime, but it was a persistent one that I didn't even really entirely realize was going on. And that was, I'd always thought that, and I think I built this up probably because of drinking, you know, because the stepkids, everybody seemed like they were living a pretty constructive life. And I always wanted to be a little more unconventional, and I just felt like, even in my family, I didn't quite fit in and all this. So my thing was, my mother just doesn't like me as much as the other kids. Wah. And so I would make her worry about me enough to call me, just so I could feel like she cared. And I did that even sober. And so we're talking with my sponsor in the fifth step, and we're talking about all this, and about this... my youngest stepsister had a child out of wedlock, and my mother raised that kid. And when I got married, my mother and the family came to the wedding, and this little girl was there. And I had never really been around her that much because I didn't live in Kansas anymore. And my mom was saying, "Oh, can she do the book where people sign it?" You know, and I'm thinking, "I'm Bridezilla. Yeah, okay, whatever." And so in the resentment, what my sponsor said to me was, you know, it's your job to love your mother. And I can't really explain exactly the chain of events in our discussion, but what happened was that all of that story about all of those things that I thought were true, it talks about fancy to real, I suddenly saw that my whole thinking for decades had been a fancied thing. And so my job was to then call my mom all the time, talk to her, and that's what we've been doing now. This was quite a while back. You know, I was 10 years sober, so for, 26 years now, I've been calling my mom every week. And she always says, "Don't stop calling me." We're going to have her 90th birthday in May. And so we're buddies, we're peas and carrots. So I wasn't right about that at all. So I became a bit of a, how would you say, a salesperson of the steps like that, because it was so amazing for me, and realizing, okay, now, so I'm going to be in Ohio, and I don't know that many people, but if somebody wants me to sponsor them, I've got a track to run on that's very clear and very precise and works. And that was so wonderful. I sponsored some women there. I sponsored some women through inappropriate to appropriate to marriage. You know, take note, all you, no, I'm just kidding. I can do that, no, they do it. It's not, actually not they doing it, it's higher power, you know, we surrender. But anyway, so just a little of that, a little of that. Moved to Virginia, a couple of years I'm kind of like walking around like Diogenes with my lamp looking for someone who's doing the big book like we are, and not seeing a lot of that, but I ran into this woman called Linda from Hampton who also knew Don P. and them from Colorado, because he had done workshops in Florida, and her friends were bugging her to bring him to Virginia in about the year 2000. So what happened was we met his sponsee, Val, and they had been doing a lot of active big book in their home group up in Richmond, and that was very important for me because it never quite, you know, I wasn't in LA long enough when I was doing it to sort of make a bunch of people around me that were doing it, because for me, this is how I want to sponsor people, and so having, you know, like, this group has a clear message, right? So I wanted a group to have a clear message, and they were very helpful, Jaywalkers, they were very helpful in our kind of getting that started. So our home group started, Fellowship of the Spirit started in 2002. And we had a bunch of people that we would be in these groups outside of meetings and do the steps out of the book together, and then we could sponsor people doing that. And so it kind of, how would you say, it sort of began to wave across the country. But that's, like it says in the book, you know, we can find the fellowship we crave. And it's not like life is just special and wonderful every minute, but as Clancy would say, he likes to make sure that there's a lot of fences between him and the edge, him and taking the drink, you know? And what would that consist of? That would be that you have a home group, you have a sponsorship that you work with, you have people that are around you that are doing the same things that you are doing, and they will support you in sponsoring people in doing those same things. Because many of you, I'm sure, have had the experience of talking with someone that you're sponsoring, and they say something about, hey, I need you to talk to me about this problem. Something comes out of your mouth, and it's kind of like the thing that you need to hear. You know, like, I've been thinking about that. I needed that answer. So the real deal here is to carry the message after you have it. What does it say? Trust God, clean house, carry the message. So doing the things with the people that I know, love, and trust that rely on our basic text to work the steps has given me a life that I was afraid that I wouldn't have. I didn't know that I would live beyond age 30 when I was drinking. And now I want to live as long as I can. And anyway, I'm just want to say some nice things here about you all tonight. First of all, this is a wonderful gathering. Look at everybody here, a lot of people. Wonderful food, friendly, and I'm really glad you have it. And I want to thank David for inviting me to speak here. And I just want to say that I'm really grateful to all of you in Alcoholics Anonymous and for my sobriety, and thank you.
There were baskets around here earlier. Home group? Baskets? Got them? Thank you so much, Phyllis. I love you. Seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It's both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Although our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world, we may want to remember that a dollar does not support as many services as it used to. Are there any announcements for the good of AA tonight?
My name is Katie, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Katie.
My home group, AA 101, we are having our half-anniversary 1 month from today, June 30th. Northern General in the Brick House classroom Sundays. So brunch starts at 10 a.m., speaker at 11.
Thank you. What's the date on that again?
June
30th. Any others?
Stay alcoholic. I'm going to keep this as short as possible. So
shorter.
Shorter? Okay. Shorter, better. My home group, Tax on Hanging Sober, is having an ARC meeting that's going to be May 31st, the last Thursday of May. The theme is Sloppy Joe's, so if you want to come on out, you can bring whatever you want. We're just going to toss that chicken around, and cook the chicken, it'll be fun. But other than that, we also have a couple other things and events going on. In May 19th, there is a workshop that is going to be happening in Williamsburg. This is AA, it is based off of the pamphlet. If you need information, come see me after the meeting. That is to support VISCUPA, and VISCUPA is Virginia State Conference of Young People in AA. That is happening in October, the last weekend of October. If you need flyers or are interested in pre-registration for that or want to be a part of the committee, get into service. There's a bunch of people here who are part of that committee. You can come see me or them after this meeting. In addition to anything other YPA related, because all the holidays are going to have YPA events, a bunch of us are going. Get in the car and go. Talk to me. I've got a crap ton of flyers in my car. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you.
Any other announcements? Right on. The Simple Actions Group is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members. And newcomers, you're the reason we're here tonight. Is there anybody in their first 30 days of sobriety? Could we just get your first name, please? We'd like to welcome you. You don't have to.
Stephanie,
welcome. Gary, welcome. Jake, welcome. Wilson, welcome. Grant, welcome. Tim. Welcome. I'm feeling like three more. Matthew, welcome. Come on, give it up. All right. Don't run off after the meeting. Somebody will talk to you. Let's see, there's literature available, a lovely assortment of books and things like that. If you can fold it, it's free. The books have price usually written in the cover. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you do not delay. If you have any questions or would like additional information on sponsorship, I'll be up here after the meeting. Come talk to me. I'll talk to all of you. Smokers are reminded, please use the butt can that's provided outside and stay well away from the church doors. There are other things happening at the church tonight. Grant, would you stand up? And Morgan, Malcolm. Who else knows how to put this room back together again? These guys know how to put the room back together again. Basically, all these chairs are going to stay down. The tables are going to go up. So as the Spirit moves you, if you want to help us with that, that'd be awesome. And could we please thank Phyllis one more time? And thanks again to everyone who just helped make this a nice event. Just bringing your good cheer or food or just your fine self. Thanks for coming out tonight. Can we make a big circle and close with the Lord's Prayer?
Thy kingdom come, thy will be done.